This is John Brotherhood, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee via Skype on the 15th, 16th and 17th of January 2013. John Brotherhood, Part 2.
Can we move on now to the events of November? And you were out.
Yes.
You were out sledging with.
Yes.
Jim Shercliffe.
Yes.
Tell me what happened from your point of view.
Well, Jim and I had planned to do. I wanted to do a physiological measurements of people man hauling sledges. It hadn't been done before, and that was one of the reasons I was there. Jim was willing to be a subject, so we planned to do this man hauling sledge where we'd go out to, I think it was Mobster Creek, if I recall. The plan was to then go down onto the sea ice, have a look at the emperor penguins, and then go from the sea ice back to Halley Bay and back up the chute there and back to base. And that was a sort of a reasonable day's trip. When the day for this expedition arrived, it was overcast, but the visibility was excellent. The visibility must have been, you know, at least 20 miles, because you could actually see the hinge zone, which is where the continental ice comes down to the ice shelf. So there was very good visibility. But I remember as I pulled the sledge up the ramp, Fanny Hill was standing at the top of the ramp, and he said to me, "Oh, you shouldn't be going out today, Doc, in whiteout." And I think I probably said to him, I said, "Oh, yeah, the visibility is pretty good, Fanny." Anyway, Jim and I went off, and we came to Mobster Creek, and these creeks are splits in the edge of the ice shelf, where the ice shelf meets the sea ice. And it splits like when you're rolling out pastry, the edge of the pastry splits, and it splits in the same way. And depending on the orientation to the prevailing wind, you get a big snow drift drifts up the side of the split. So you can actually get from the ice shelf down the drift into the bottom of the creek and out onto the ice shelf. And that was what we were aiming to do. What actually happened was that Jim said, "Oh well, we've arrived at the drift now, Doc." And so he went in the front to lead the way down the drift, and I was at the back of the sledge. And we started to proceed down the down what we thought was the drift down onto the or ramp down onto the ice onto the bottom of the creek. I can remember Jim sort of saying, "It's getting bloody steep here, Doc." And the next thing is we really went over the edge. And we'd missed the drift. We'd actually gone over a cornice. And my recollection of the reason for that was that there were we'd actually been following a pegged route. So we'd followed a drum line. But we used old oil drums to fuel drums to mark the route. And we'd gone down that route. And then followed some pegs down to get down onto the sea ice. But in fact, something that I think I certainly wasn't aware of it, there were two sets of pegs. There were some pegs that had been put in by the glaciologists for glaciological surveying, and then there were the route marking pegs. The glaciologist pegs didn't actually mark the route, and we'd taken the wrong set of pegs. And so instead of going down the drift to the bottom of the creek, we just missed the drift. Jim, I think, landed in the edge of the drift into fairly soft snow, and that broke his fall, very fortunately for both of us. And so he just injured both his ankles pretty badly. But I think I must have landed on something much harder, and I jackknifed and struck my face on my knee. I can remember more or less immediately after the fall, you know, sort of saying, "Well, that wasn't too good," or "But that effect, I suppose," and saying to Jim that I'd I didn't injure my back, that I had a lot of pain in my back. And then I don't remember anything. I don't know whether I lost, well, obviously lost consciousness. And the next thing I remember is waking up in the tent and Jim offering me a cup of soup or tea or something. I don't know how long he'd been trying to rouse me, or whether I, you know, I sort of woke up when he sort of roused me. But anyway, there we were in the tent. So Jim, quite remarkably, had managed to get me onto a ground sheet and direct the tent around us. And, you know, as I say, we had got a brew going. And basically, of course, you know, we were then pretty safe. I mean, because, you know, we were protected from the weather. And, you know, we had food and warmth.
Was it just lucky that the sledge came down with you and therefore you had access to your equipment?
Yes, I mean, yeah, sure. Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's right. I mean, we were fully equipped. I mean, it wasn't as though we sort of just taken off with a, you know, box of sandwiches. We never left the base for more than, you know, a few minutes at a time without full camping equipment. I do remember being a little bit concerned about our medical equipment, whether we had adequate medical equipment, because most of the medical equipment had gone out with the field parties that had gone down to the mountains. But then we had sufficient.
Were you able to drink this soup because you had facial damage, I think?
Yes, I was. Yes, I could take liquid stuff. I mean, I think at that stage I probably wasn't. I mean, I knew I had backache, and I can't remember about my face very much. I think Jim might have remarked that I looked as though I'd been in a prize fight or something. But my main concern was my back. And I remember giving myself, we had little tubes of morphine, they were like little small toothpaste tubes of a dose of morphine. And I can remember giving myself that to try to relieve the pain and not being very impressed. I don't know whether the stuff was out of date or something. It was old ex-Army stock stuff. But anyway,
you had the presence of mind to keep a list of the medication you gave yourself.
I don't remember that. Might have done. That might have been when we were on base, when we got back to base. Or Jim would have known.
Yeah. So it was a case really of sitting and waiting.
Yes. By this time, it had actually started to snow. I mean, it wasn't a blizzard. It was absolutely still. It was just. I suppose, in fact, rather pretty snow. It was just sort of little snowflakes coming down without any wind. But maybe the visibility had deteriorated by that time. But certainly, the question is, why did we go on that trip? As I say, my recollection is that we weren't concerned about apparent whiteout condition because there was very good visibility. It wasn't as though the cloud was right down. There wasn't any fog. It wasn't that sort of extreme type of visibility. And as I mentioned before, Sydney was overcast all the time. I mean, if we'd waited for clear days of Sydney, we would have never gone outside. So, you know, it wasn't unusual for the conditions to be overcast. But what I guess I certainly hadn't fully appreciated was that there's absolutely no relief. If there's no shadow on the ice shelf, if there's no shadow, you have absolutely no relief at all. So we couldn't see the fact that we were going over a cornice rather than down the snowdrift. The other aspect of this, I think, was probably what's sometimes known as target syndrome, that I think we just sort of decided to go on this trip. I was pretty keen to get this physiology done. And I think, you know, maybe that to some extent had perhaps sort of clouded our judgment a little. I don't know.
And you were led astray by the glaciological pegs.
That's my recollection. That's my recollection. I mean, I don't know what Jim says about that.
Was there... Was there any kind of inquest when he got back to base?
On base?
Yeah. Or later. Was there any analysis of why things had gone wrong?
Not on base. So, well, certainly not as far as I can recall. I'm sure we must have related what happened. But of course, both Jim and I were significantly injured, I guess. I think at that stage we were probably rather more concerned with, attending to sort of medical matters. And then before we knew where we were, of course, the Americans had said they were going to come over and pick me up.
Well, let's just go back slightly to you were sitting in the tent still. How long did he have to wait for rescue?
I can't remember. I don't know. Maybe a day, something like that.
Day and a half?
Yeah, probably. I really can't remember.
Do you remember who came?
Well, my recollection is that the first person to put their head through the door of the tent was Alan Johnson. And I remember being actually quite amused by the look of great concern and consternation on his face, because perhaps he was wondering what he was going to find, were we dead or alive, so as it were, or how badly injured were we. But Fanny Hill tells me it was actually him who put his head round the door. Whoever it was, their expression of concern and consternation was very memorable.
Hill tells me that he and Johnson nearly fell down the same crevasse that you did.
Oh, yes. I mean, and that's the dreadful thing about these sorts of incidents is that, it puts other people at danger. Yeah. When I read that email from Fanny Hill just very recently, I hadn't heard that particular aspect of it. I just assumed that they'd gone down the right route, which was actually reasonably safe. I hadn't realised that they'd got thrown off course as well and nearly made the same mistake. Doesn't bear thinking of. That's chilly, that sort of information.
How did he get back?
Back to base? I can't remember the sort of exact details, but I guess the tent was taken down. We were both put on. Jim couldn't walk, and I obviously couldn't walk, or it wasn't safe for me to walk. I was very carefully handled and strapped to a sledge, and hauled back to base. I don't remember. I can remember being very well wrapped up and very warm and basically being quite comfortable, obviously very relieved, I guess, to be picked up. I can't remember much else about that.
Do you remember being X-rayed?
Yes, indeed. Then there are further interesting stories here, actually, because we could get into base down the ramp down into the garage. The garage, as you know, Halley Bay drifts up very quickly. By this time, most of the huts were actually drifted up, so the only way of getting in and out of the huts were up and down vertical shafts, except for the tractor shed, which had a ramp, which was bulldozed clear all the time. So, obviously I was taken down the ramp. But when we were building and fitting out the base, when we looked at the plans, we thought that the plans for the surgery were pretty silly, because there was just an ordinary door opening from a fairly standard passage, and it was absolutely clear that it was not going to be possible. Any man who was badly injured or ill and was basically had to be on a stretcher, we couldn't have got him into the surgery, which would have to be act as the hospital and the medical room. So Big Al built folding doors so that we could actually open the wall up. It was a partition wall. We could actually open the wall up at the surgery and get get a stretcher, or in this case the sledge, actually into the surgery, and then I was lifted off the sledge. So it was very lucky that we'd actually done that, because it did mean that I could be put onto the couch, the medical couch in the surgery, really without any sort of drastic movement of my back. And at that stage, I knew I'd injured my back fairly badly, but I didn't know what I'd done. We had an old ex-army field x-ray machine on the base, and our electrician, a chap called Wharton, I just can't remember his first name, either because he was the electrician or maybe he'd even had some experience with using x-ray apparatus. Anyway, basically we read the instructions, plugged in the x-ray machine, and there was x-ray film there, we x-rayed Jim's ankles, and I was able to determine that he hadn't actually fractured anything, that he just had rather severe sprains of his ankles. And we x-rayed my back, and I was able to sort of confirm that I'd fractured a couple of vertebrae in my back. And I think we probably x-rayed my head as well. My upper left jaw, the teeth had been caved in, and I couldn't chew on that side because all my teeth were caved in. I'd struck my face on my knee, obviously pretty hard. I mean, in fact, I jackknifed, and that's what had crushed the vertebrae. And I'd also smashed my face, and that had caved my teeth in. So anyway, so the x-ray, that was all worked very well. We were actually able to make useful diagnoses. One of the things that concerned me was that I was getting some clear sort of straw-coloured fluid down my nose, and I was a bit concerned that this might have been cerebrospinal fluid. That's the fluid that surrounds the brain, and I thought, well, if I fractured my face, I might have just fractured the bone between the skull and my sort of nose, and that this was cerebrospinal fluid coming. That concerned me a bit, because that was a potential route of infection to the inside the skull, and meningitis and so on. So I think on hindsight, it probably wasn't cerebrospinal fluid, but at the time, that was my concern. So I gave myself pretty sort of good doses of antibiotics. The cook, I think, produced nice soup and liquid food, and I got on with it.
Did you ever fear for your life at all?
No, I don't think so. No, I can't remember feeling threatened in that sense. Obviously, I remember being very thankful, first of all, that we were both alive. And secondly, of course, that Jim, got us into the tent. I mean, if he hadn't done that, I think we probably would have been goners.
What was the first indication that the Americans were going to get involved?
Ricky Chin just came into the surgery, where I was in bed, as it were, actually just on the surgery couch. And said, the Americans will be here, and I think he said something like 5 hours to take you to New Zealand. Oh, it was literally as short as that. The Americans were actually already in the air, and possibly at that time might have even been at refueling at South Pole. And that's the sort of warning that they had. That's my recollection. Other people may say that it was a longer period of time. Just going back a bit, if you remember, I spoke a little bit about my injuries and that I fractured my face and was a bit concerned about that I might have fractured my skull and was leaking this cerebrospinal fluid. And I sent a telegram to London with full clinical details, because I thought it was important that if my condition should deteriorate, experts in the UK would you know, have as much information as possible on which to advise, you know, my colleagues, companions at base. And the question is, of course, is how the Americans learned about my condition. There would have been a lot of traffic between Halley Bay and Stanley in the Falkland Islands, and then, of course, from Stanley to London. And whether so, and then I have very recently learned that it's likely that a US Navy listening post somewhere in Central America might have picked up the traffic between Halley Bay, Falkland Islands, and London, and that that might have triggered it off. But even the Americans today, this man, Michael Spencer, who was the navigator on the Hercules airplane that took me out to McMurdo, is trying to find out what it was that set the whole business in train. So,
in his book, Ice and Men, Fuchs suggests that he, in fact, rang a friend of his in the American government, but that wasn't able to happen until Monday morning because your accident took place on Friday afternoon.
Yes. Oh, well, that okay, that could be true. In fact, you're quite right. I think I might have got that from an email with Alan Smith, a Big Al Smith, recently, but I wasn't aware of that.
Right. Okay. So, when they arrived, what happened?
So can we just there's just one other thing which, in fact, you may be aware of, that whilst the traffic between my accident and Stanley and the Americans was going on, this is the radio traffic, Deception Island blew up.
I know. Ted Clapp was on the radio, wasn't he?
Yeah. And so, in fact, then I think there was a loss of communication between Halley and Stanley, because, of course, Stanley were very concerned with what was happening on Deception Island.
So when the Americans arrived, what was the next thing that happened? What do you recall?
What I recall is a tall fellow in a red anorak who was a naval doctor, a youngish fellow, probably about my age, in fact, came in and did a clinical assessment and looked at the x-rays and rather agreed with the diagnoses that I'd made both on Jim and myself. He considered that I was getting dehydrated. The other person I remember coming into the base was a photographer who had, I think, at least three Nikons round his neck. And in those days, Nikons were rather the sort of premier camera. And the fact that a bloke could have three round his neck was, you know, something to be remarked upon.
I think that the medic who came with the Americans was Dr. Knoll, N-O-L-L, is that correct?
Yes, I think that is right. There was, in fact, another Knoll on the airplane who was a pilot.
Okay. So,
but not related.
So were you assessed, basically, to see whether you were fit to travel?
Yes. And I think he sort of confirmed the diagnosis, or at least the fractures to my back, and that probably they were what we call stable, that the risk of my getting a spinal cord injury was probably not too great. And then having done that, which I can't remember, I don't think it took very long, then I was wrapped up in sleeping bags and put on a sledge and taken out of the plane.
Were you in pain still at this point, or had the Americans been able to alleviate that?
No, I really can't, you know, it's funny. I mean, I can remember having a pretty sore back, or very painful back, I guess, immediately after the fall. And in the tent, you know, at the bottom of the creek. But after that, I can't remember being in sort of desperate discomfort. I may have taken some analgesics. But I can't remember that. I I really don't. I certainly don't remember being suffering a great deal of pain at any time, apart from initially.
You flew to Christchurch.
Yes, the aeroplane, the Hercules, well, just before we get there, I was loaded onto the Hercules. And at some point, just before takeoff, an American chap who I thought might have been an engineer came up to me and said, "Well, Lord Duck, we're not too familiar with this strip, so we're going to use jet-assisted takeoff to help. So if you feel a bit of a kick in the pants and hear a great roar, don't be worried, that's just the rockets." And duly the plane sort of taxied off for a takeoff run, and there was indeed a terrific roar and this great sensation of acceleration. And according to Michael Spencer, takeoff in 70 yards.
Gosh.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. Most amazing, extraordinary airplane. Wonderful airplane, Hercules.
Are you familiar with how it got down, to, how it landed?
Oh, yes, all the story about the strip.
Hello?
About marking the landing strip with cocoa and drums.
Yeah.
Yes, 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 indeed. I mean, I heard about that later.
Okay.
I have actually got some sort of more contemporary information about that. I think the boys were a bit surprised that the plane actually landed some distance from the oil drums and the arrow that I think they'd used to indicate the most appropriate landing place. Apparently, they thought it was an experiment of some sort and didn't want to disturb that. And the other point was that they didn't want to be anywhere near the oil drums because, of course, if they veered off course or anything like that, they wanted to be well away from any, potential source of damage. So whilst they were grateful for the sort of the information of the landing strip, they didn't, in fact, use what the FIDS had intended them to use.
This is coming from Michael Spencer, is it, the navigator?
Yes, yes.
On the Hercules. Yeah. So how did he get in touch with Michael?
Oh, well, he actually got in touch with me because he's researching their flight, their Operation Deep Freeze U.S. Navy flight was VX-6. And he's, I think, sort of researching history and come personal memoir of the VX-6 flight time in the Antarctic. And obviously, this was a very important episode in their two tours down there. I think he was down there in 67 and 68. So that's what he dug me out of, as one does now, by Googling my name, I think, and tracing me through the university.
So what was it like to get that call or that email? Is it strange to hear again after all these years?
I'd already sort of rather half-heartedly started doing a little bit of research because, I mean, although, I was the subject of all the kerfuffle, I didn't really have any idea about how it had affected people on base. And because I went off to New Zealand and then went back to the Falkland Islands, I really didn't catch up with any of my contemporaries at Halibay, apart from Ricky Chin and Jim Shetcliffe briefly. And there was never really, we really never discussed the broader impact on the base. And so it's sort of recently, since I've been retired, I sort of thought, well, I really ought to try and find out a little bit more about this and perhaps sort of write down something about it. So Michael's communication and continuing correspondence with me was rather rather timely.
Did you learn anything else from Michael which was of interest?
Only the point about why they landed away from the marked strip, the very short takeoff, And then the question about how many aircraft were involved. Apparently, there were two aircraft that might have been involved, so there's some discussion of that. The other thing I was, of course, interested in a bit is how they navigated at that time down there, because it was, long before. Well, in fact, a satellite GPS was just coming in 1967, I think, 66, 67. But they were not using it as a routine navigational aid. And he just said, well, they used Astro and some curious compass, which I couldn't understand, something to do with magnetic dip, as far as I could make out. I'm going to have to ask him more about that. Classic seat-of-the-pants navigation.
According to Ice and Men, there were two Hercules, one of which never landed. It just circled round as a backup.
That's right, yeah. I'm not sure if it circled round at Halley Bay or further south.
Tell me about the hospital in Christchurch.
Oh, can I tell you a bit more about the journey?
Of course.
Yeah.
That's why we're
right,
here.
So you're asking me about the flight, yes, indeed. Well, you asked me about the flight. First of all, we were flown directly. I was flown directly to Williams Field, McMurdo, on McMurdo Sound. But on the way there, Dr. Noel put up a drip because he thought I was dehydrated. I don't remember very much about that trip, and it's quite possible that he gave me a sedative, or certainly I think I must have slept most of the time. I remember landing, I remember the back of the plane opening at Williams Field, and seeing probably Mount Erebus or the other smoking volcano down. I think it's Erebus. Seeing the volcano in the background, according to Michael Spencer, I wouldn't have been able to see that in the plane that they flew me in, because it had a big fuel tank in it. So it must have been the plane that took me to New Zealand. Anyway, I saw Mount Erebus. Then we took off to go to Christchurch. I should imagine fairly quickly after landing at Williams Field, and we flew off to Christchurch. Well, on the way to Christchurch, I became desperate to have a pee. And on base, I'd just been, I can't remember whether I'd been kneeling up or just putting my feet over the edge of the couch. Anyway, I'd been peeing all right there. And so I said to the doctor, another doctor whose name, unfortunately, I can't remember, an older man, I said to him, look, I can't, I really need a pee. So he produced a urine bottle, out of this airplane. I just couldn't get anything to happen at all. It was, really very desperate and most uncomfortable. So I said to him, I tell you what, if I just kneel up, I'm sure I'll be able to pee. And he said, oh, no, he didn't want me to do that because he was a bit concerned I might sort of disrupt things in my back. So he tried to catheterize me couldn't get the catheter in. All this is going on this airplane, so they had a pretty comprehensive medical kit. I said, well, look, I'm quite sure if I kneel, I'll be able to pee. So he said, oh, okay. And I did get up and pee, and I had this wonderful pee. It was just marvelous relief. so that was the highlight of that trip to Christchurch. Then I arrived, we arrived in Christchurch, of course, and I was taken out of the plane. And one of the most vivid memories of the whole business was these two absolutely immaculate U.S. naval officers walking across the tarmac to greet me. And it was Admiral Abbott, who was the CNC of Operation Deep Freeze, and his AOC, or is that the word, ADC. And just the image of those two people, just to me, summed up the really astonishing professionalism of the whole business. It just was the most extraordinary and professional operation. I was very impressed. That really just brought home to me, I think, the great professionalism of the U.S. Navy in this particular operation.
Were you nursed in a U.S. Navy or a U.S. hospital or a New Zealand hospital?
I was admitted to the public hospital in Christchurch, and really handed over to the public health, public hospital system in Christchurch. I'm pretty sure that the New Zealand Health Service and the National Health Service had a reciprocal arrangement. So in any case, I was just treated as a New Zealand public hospital. I was sort of initially assessed in the public hospital in Christchurch, and then I was moved to another hospital the burns and plastic surgery and facial maxillary hospital just outside Christchurch. It specialized really in, as I say, people with burns and plastic surgery and facial maxillary work. And because of my facial injury, I went there where my jaws were wired together so that my mandible, my lower jaw, acted as a splint for my fractured and dislocated left upper jaw.
You had a visit from a senior FID in hospital, Ray Ady.
Yes, I think that is right. Yes, yes, that's right. I'd forgotten that, but that's right. That does remind me. Yes, I think that's right.
And then eventually you were convalesced with another old FID, veteran FID, Bernard Stonehouse and his wife.
Well, that's right. Two very nice things happened in the hospital. First of all, I was visited by a chap called David Brown, who had emigrated from England to Christchurch many years before, about 15 years previously. And he had been a great friend of mine when I was, he was actually a lot older than I was, when I was a boy. He really taught me all about fishing, and we used to go fishing a lot together, and he taught me all the sort of basic fishing skills. And he turned up, he'd read about my arrival in the newspaper, and he turned up. And then Bernard turned up rather delightfully, just with a single rose, which was very appropriate because I'm very fond of gardening and flowers, so it really sort of hit the spot as far as I was concerned. And then his family came along, Sally and their three children, Anne, Caroline, and Paul. And when I was released from the hospital, they very kindly sort of, adopted me for quite a few weeks at their home in Kashmir, in the Kashmir Hills, just outside Christchurch. Very generous of them.
Looking back on the whole episode, the whole accident, is there any way it could have been avoided? Was there any procedures that could have been introduced that would have prevented the accident from happening? Or was it just bad luck?
Well, as I said initially, I suppose we might have taken a bit more notice of the weather, the lighting conditions, and the fact that there was no relief on the ice. I suppose we could have taken more note of that, but as I say, we were rather sort of motivated to complete our round trip for whatever reason, which involved going down, as it said, down the creek onto the sea ice. Yes, the whole thing could have been avoided if we'd simply gone down the drum line to the end of the drum line, which was a few miles, turned round and come back again. Mm. It's easy to be wise after the event.
Of course. There was a ceremony in Washington the following year. Were you invited to that?
No, and I wasn't even aware of it.
This was...
And at least, if I was told about it, I have not, I can't, I, it's not something that I remember.
Okay.
That was when they presented the plaque, was it?
That's right.
Yes. Yes, I wasn't aware of that.
Is there anything else at least, you wanted to say about that episode in your life, or shall we look at other things now?
No, I think that... I think we've covered it really very well.
Yeah. I've got some more points to ask you about, if I may.
Yes.
Going back over the last couple of years of being in the Antarctic, you were trying to weigh leftover food when as part of the human biology program. And Dave stroke Fanny Hill says that you agreed to do GASH to weigh all the leftover food. And he reckons that the leftover food was booby-trapped by the FIDs.
They're a rotten lot, weren't they?
Is this true?
I really don't remember that being made particularly difficult. They may have thought that they'd booby-trapped it, but I guess I was fairly intent in, sorting. I mean, if it had a case we'd had some stew with mashed potatoes and peas... I think this is what Dave might have referred to. I probably didn't find it too difficult to sort out the peas from the mashed potato.
Which we say carefully mixed together to make it more difficult for you.
Yeah, well, they might have done that. the main problem at Halley Bay was that because the old base and the new base were running together and the best kitchen facilities were on the new base. All the bread for the old base was baked in the new base, and that made things very difficult because I couldn't really keep track of the flour that was being consumed on the new base where I was making my studies. So that was the greatest difficulty. But actually, my recollection is I had pretty good cooperation. I measured individual food intakes at Halley Bay, and when I analysed the results, it all seemed reasonably sensible.
On other medical matters, there's a note here about a urine examination of John Baker. What can you tell me about that?
Oh, yes. Well, now, the point I wanted to make about that was that Sydney, being a biological base, had these, people with these laboratory skills. And as I told you before, John Baker had done, worked as a path lab technician, hospital lab technician, as vocational jobs. And I had a particular patient on one of the ships who had what seemed to be a urinary tract problem. And John analyzed the urine for that and came up with some findings, pathological findings. And the other thing was that this chap who had his appendix out, we had another chap, I think it was a man called Barry Goodman, who was looking at the embryology of penguins. And so he was very skilled in cutting microscopic sections. So he actually made microscopic sections of the appendix that we removed. And we still had them. So I just wanted to make that point that, there were all those skills there that were actually very helpful in the medical sense.
Well, what about the wildlife around Sydney? What particularly impressed you? Were there fur seals around at this time?
No. That's the point I made, that I think it's true to say that the first sighting of a fur seal since, if you like, the fur seal industry, the first fur seal sighting since the base had been established at Sydney Island, I think I'm right in saying that we observed that, a bull fur seal. I think it was the first time a fur seal had been observed at Sydney. So that was, I think, of interest. You might need to check that with somebody like Bob Burton,
Okay. And you were your team was studying the Weddell seals as well and tagging them.
Well, yes, there was an ongoing there were ongoing programs of bird ringing, and of course the main objective there was to find out really how long, what the breeding life of the various birds were. Those were mostly the birds that nested in the cliffs. So the petrels and the snowy petrel and the Cape pigeons and so on. But the other thing, the other long ongoing program was tagging Weddell seals. And I think it'd be right to say that one of the highlights of the year was when the Weddell cows hauled out onto the ice to pup. They came up through sort of holes that I guess, like breathing holes that they'd cut in the ice and came up through cracks on the ice, on the tide crack, and hauled out onto the ice and pupped. And so there were quite a large number of these enormously fat seals delivering these tiny little bundles of fur and sort of very rubbery fur. It was just rather extraordinary that these little things could be born into this cold, cold climate. And the afterbirth, or the placenta, which of course follow the pups, was very quickly taken up by the sheathbills. But then the other thing that was interesting to observe was that how the pups, of course, fed voraciously from their mothers. And then with a matter of days, they became very swollen little creatures, and their mothers shrank rapidly in size. So the transfer of energy, of fat, from the mothers to the pups was extraordinary. And then after a few weeks, there came the swimming lessons, when the pups had first to go into the sea, and these rather charming sights of the mothers going down into the breathing holes and their heads coming up and encouraging their pups to go into the water. So that was rather nice. And the pups bleat just like lambs. So I think all of us were rather moved by this in one way or another. It was all rather nice. Both the cows and the pups were tagged. And this involved grabbing the rear flipper of the mother seal and reading the tag that had been put on previously, so we knew who she was and where she'd previously been tagged, and then also tagging the pups, so of course they could be followed through, hopefully to the time that they didn't return. Mm.
There's also a note about you monitoring the heart rate of Steve O'Shawn.
Yes, this was, I'd forgotten this little detail, which is part of sort of Steve's humour. Part of my research was to measure people's resting energy expenditure. So really the best time to do that was first thing in the morning before people got up. And at the same time, I used to measure their heart rate. And I was interested in see whether these things would change throughout the year. And I always noticed that Steve's heart rate was always quite high. It was always about 10 or 15 beats higher than everybody else's. So I mentioned this to Steve. I said to him, your heart rate's always a bit high. And, I think this might have caused him a little bit of concern that maybe there's something wrong. And I said, no, I don't think it's anything wrong. I think it's just the way you are. And then one morning I was taking his heart rate, and he said, well, what's it like today, Doc? So I said, oh, it's the usual sort of 85 or what it was. And he said, you don't think it could be due to that, do you, Doc? So I said, due to what? And he pointed up above his head, and strapped to the bottom of the bunk above him, there was a full-length nude lady. And I think Steve thought maybe that was raising his heart rate.
Did you agree?
I said I thought it might be a factor.
moving on to Hallie, there was some, again, you very kindly give me some notes here, John, which I'm very grateful for. Moving on to Hallie, there was the philosophical question about the correct size of a dunny pit.
Yeah, well, I seem to remember that being a rather lively conversation about how big this pit should be, that if there were going to be, say, 24 people on base for a 10 years, we hope the base might last. How big should this pit be? And there was a, well, come on, Duck, how much shit does a bloke produce in a day? So you can imagine the sort of general gist of the conversation. But eventually, very large pit and deep pit was dug.
And whilst you didn't have much medical work to do, there wasn't an outbreak of tonsillitis.
Oh, no. Yes, this was quite interesting. One man got classic... streptococcal tonsillitis, an absolutely classic diagnosis, in just after midwinter. This was really very strange because infectious diseases like that, as I'm sure you know, are very unusual in the Antarctic. And usually a tonsillitis, you have to have some source of infection. Anyway, I isolated him because I didn't want it to sort of spread to other people, obviously, and with sort of usual treatment and so on, he recovered perfectly well. But then when I went back to the Falkland Islands, when I was in the Falkland Islands before going to Halley Bay, I'd visited Malcolm Slessor, who was the doctor in Stanley, and he told me that they'd had a rather virulent strain of streptococcal tonsillitis going in the previous in that summer when the FIDS were going through. And this man, as I say, he developed his illness just after midwinter when he'd been wearing a suit, which he hadn't worn since he'd been to a dance in Stanley. So it seems almost certain, I think, there must have been some bacteria, spores or whatever, on his suit, which he must have just infected himself with when he wore that suit at midwinter. That's certain speculation, but it's an interesting speculation.
And you were doing some work, medical work on the dogs.
Oh, yes, veterinary work. I mean, the medics, were sort of jacks of all medical trade, medicine, dentistry, and veterinary work. And we had, from time to time, the dogs would get in a scrap and they would get, they'd sort of tear at each other. And some of them occasionally got quite bad tears. So stitching dogs up after a fight was something that I did from time to time. But there were a couple of interesting cases. A couple of young dogs had a condition that's called entropion. An entropion is a condition where the eyelashes turn in so that they irritate the eyeball. It's very often associated with inbreeding. And although FIDS were pretty careful about their dog breeding, from time to time, I think dogs and bitches got together, for unplanned couplings. Anyway, these two young dogs had this condition, which was very distressing for them. So it's a fairly simple condition to treat. You would simply take a little slip of skin out of the upper eyelid, sew it together again, so it just draws the lashes out away from the eye. But the question was how to anaesthetize these animals. And I didn't really know how to do this, but I thought that some doses of human tranquilizers might do the trick. So there was this interesting period of time when we sort of titrated pills, sedatives against these two dogs until finally they sort of became rather drunk and keeled over. And I was able to do the operation, which, if I recall, worked very well.
Did you also have problems with metalwork and bare hands?
I make that point we were moving a lot of gas cylinders out of a store into the tractor shed. These were big. Big cylinders, about as tall as we were. Of course, they were extremely cold. And we had been working fairly hard, and I was wearing gloves, and my hands got sweaty, and I felt that I couldn't grip these cylinders well enough with my gloves on. So really, without thinking, I took my gloves off and put my hands on these frozen, on these very cold cylinders, and of course they were instantly frozen to the cylinders. Fortunately, my reflexes were pretty quick, and I ripped them off again, but sort of took a lot of skin off the palms of my hands. But that's a little thing that, you know, one has to watch for. You sort of do it without thinking in a funny sort of way.
We haven't talked about the beauty of Antarctica and whether you were, as you hoped to have been when you set off to go there, impressed by the place geographically and geophysically.
Yes, Cygni, of course, is a wonderful place. Huge numbers of birds, a great variety of birds. Cygni, the base at Cygni, was built on the old site of the old whaling plan. But it looked across to Coronation Island. And the main feature of Coronation Island there was the Sunshine Glacier, which was really like a big coombe, I suppose you would call it, which even when the weather was overcast, the mountains were high enough behind it to be in the sunshine. And you'd get this wonderful effect of the sun shining down onto the ice and onto the snow and to the glacier below through the clouds. So that was very, very nice. And Cygni was, I mean, for anybody who loves the outdoors and loves hill walking, it was just, you know, just a magic place, a wonderful place to be. Halley Bay I found very interesting too, because although it was dead flat, there were always interesting things like the icebergs being elevated by...
Mirage,
that's right, mirages. So the icebergs that were basically... you know, pretty well below the horizon, you could see them. And you could see the ship. When the ship departed, we could see the ship for quite some time, even though it had probably gone below the horizon because it was lifted by the mirage effect. One thing I remember very clearly was in the winter, early in the winter, when it was when we were in 24-hour darkness, I was still living on the old base, and myself and a couple of other fellows were walking up to the new base on a Saturday evening, and it was very cold. It was absolutely still, but the temperature I remember was about minus 36. And the first thing I can remember is actually being chilled. It was a very curious sensation right through to my skin. Very strange sensation that although we were wearing quite a lot of clothing, I was wearing quite a lot of clothing, there was this sort of chilling effect. But the most marvelous thing was that whilst we were walking along, we suddenly had this amazing auroral display of these great curtains of green and yellow light sweeping across the sky. The whole sky was covered with this moving light, as you know, or aurora light, and yet everything was absolutely silent. There was no wind. You know, the only thing you could hear basically was your own breathing and your own heart rate, and there were these great displays of light in the sky. Just a wonderful, wonderful experience. And we later learned, actually, you know, as the auroral observations continued during the year, that that actually happened to be the best display of the year. So that was a fortunate experience.
This is a final question, John. I'm just wondering how your time at Bass rates in the top 10 of periods of your life.
Oh, I mean, very high. I mean, you know, I mean, of course there were. I mean, there were times when, you know, one was a little bit down, as I think we all are in our lives, you know, wherever we are. But the overall experience was an immense privilege. a wonderful experience. And I think that we were very lucky. We were at a time when there was still a sense of real, I think, adventure and pioneering. We really ran our own lives entirely down there. Radio communications, you know, they were adequate, but of course they were pretty primitive, and most of the communication was done by Morse code and teleprinters. I think one of the wonderful things about the Antarctic is there aren't any fences. There are no physical fences, and in a curious way, I think no psychological fences. I think, a wonderful freedom, and at the time of one's life, you know, as a young man, and I hope for the young women who go down now, that, you know, we were just able to fully appreciate and experience it.
Well, it's been a real privilege talking to you by this newfangled technology, John. It's been great fun.
Yeah,
thank you very much indeed.
Yep. Well, Chris, thank you. I'm most grateful to you. And I must say, I do think you're doing an enormous, a wonderful service. I think it's a very important way of really getting grips with social history. So thank you and congratulations on your hard work.